Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Don't sit down. Who wants Ed to stage dive?
No.
Next year, maybe.
Yeah. This is nice. Mosh pit at the front. Thank you for coming.
Big audience. Thank you for coming.
So we've had a wander around the festival site since we arrived here. Ed, you're quite worried about the pink sheep.
The pink sheep? I mean, we're going to be talking about the environment. And I'm wondering whether it's an early sign of environmental destruction, the pink sheep. So go on. Shall I give my reason to be cheerful?
Yes, you did.
So I was on the Trump demonstration on Friday. Should I say the anti-Trump demonstration, in case you thought I'd gone on the other one? It was absolutely brilliant. It was people from right across the political spectrum, right across different occupations who were there, and brilliant sign. My favourite sign was, "Feed him to the corgis," which was, I thought, a brilliant homemade sign.
I saw one which said, "Even the introverts are upset and we've come out especially."
And I think I'm going to read, because the audience is slightly cut off. So Piers Morgan, who I'm sure you're all really keen on, he did this interview with Donald Trump, and they've released some extracts from it. I just want to read you one extract, because it sort of shows what a genius, stable genius, the President of the United States is. He said this: "They make phenomenal things, you know, and you have different names. You can say England, you can say UK, you can say United Kingdom. So many different, you know, you have so many different names. Great Britain, I always say, which one do you prefer? Great Britain, you understand what I'm saying." So basically, I don't think he quite gets the whole Great Britain, United Kingdom, England thing, does he? Now, what's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful is I went to see the Muppets last night. Yeah, and they were absolutely wonderful. I took the boat there. It was at the old Millennium Dome in London, so I thought I'm going to treat myself and go on the river taxi. And there was a woman on the boat who'd been to the Free Tommy protest.
Right.
And she was wearing a Free Tommy T-shirt.
This is not cheerful, is it?
And a rosette which said #Trump. And I thought, where is she getting a rosette from? Like, did she make that especially?
But that isn't your cheerful thing, is it?
No, the Muppets are my cheerful thing. Yeah, yeah.
Jeff went to LA to see the Muppets. He's such a big Muppets fan.
I went last year to LA. They announced live shows, and I'd never heard of them doing live shows before. And I said to my wife, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The week I got back, they announced shows in London. It's a sore point in our marriage.
Who is your favourite Muppet character?
It's boring, but I think it's Kermit. But right. Do you have a favourite?
I thought you were going to say Beaker, but you didn't. Now look, should we say?
Does anybody remember that during 2015? Any time Ed tweeted somebody, and you must have respected their commitment every time you tweeted.
Say fuck off, Beaker. Yeah. That's why you should never look at your apps on Twitter, basically. That is my strong advice, don't you think?
Yeah. All right, so we should get on with it. Before we do so, I'll mention that later we are joined by a brilliant comedian. You may well have seen her here over the weekend at the festival. I think she performed yesterday. Jen Brister. She has a show at the Edinburgh Festival called Meaningless, and Jen is going to be coming on to pitch some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful.
But first of all, I was here 10 years ago to talk about the environment, and we're going to talk about something which is very much related to the environment. And we have an absolutely brilliant guest. His name is Simon Lewis. He's an award-winning scientist and professor of global change science at University College London. That's good. Good whoop. And he is the author of the new book, co-author, I should say, of a new book called The Human Planet, How We Created the Anthropocene. Now, the Anthropocene is something you're going to be hearing a lot about, and we're going to get him to explain it to us. But it's a chance to talk about the environment, the threat to the environment, and what we do about it. So everybody, please give an enormous latitude hand to Simon Lewis. Now, Simon, you've got this new book, and you're going to brandish it, and I strongly recommend you buy this book. It's really excellent, an excellent read, and I have read it, and Jeff has read it too, or Jeff's read bits of it. Sorry.
I skimmed it.
You skimmed it. Let me just ask a very basic question, Simon, because I know this has been raging in scientific circles, but maybe not elsewhere. What is the Anthropocene?
So the Anthropocene is the idea that humans are changing the environment, changing the planet to such an extent that they rival the important events in Earth's history. So one example is that nitrogen fertilizer production and agricultural crops remove enough nitrogen from the atmosphere as much as all natural processes put together. So that is a change that's as significant as when the modern nitrogen cycle started around 2.5 billion years ago. So a huge transformation. In terms of biodiversity, we're losing species at about between 100 and 1,000 times the rates that we see before humans walked this earth. And then at a shorter time scale still, we are seeing over the last 2.6 million years, Earth has flipped between ice ages and interglacials like we've seen over the last 10,000 years. And we've put enough carbon dioxide into the atmosphere now that that planetary metronome is going to skip a beat. So we won't have another ice age for at least 100,000 years.
Which you might think is good news, but...
But we are pushing Earth into a new super interglacial. So we're in a heat wave now across the Northern Hemisphere. And this is a portent of things to come. So the temperatures now are hot, but by mid-century, these will be quite normal temperatures for here at this time of year. So there are significant global changes happening to the planet on a fast scale. And this is important for us all because farming and human civilizations all emerged in a time of planetary stability over the last 10,000 years. And that time is over, and we are now in a new time, which we call the Anthropocene. So a combination of the words in Greek for humans and recent time, because we live now on a human-dominated planet.
And is it modern? Is it specific to modern humans? You know, we think of the past 100 years or post-industrial revolution. Is that the period that has caused the Anthropocene, or does it go back longer than that?
So scientists have a way of thinking about this. The first stage of this is to say, is Earth moving towards a new state? And most scientists will agree with that.
Simon, just say we're in the Holocene. We've previously been thought to be in the Holocene.
Holocene, exactly. Right. So starting specifically 11,650 years ago, we started the Holocene, and now we're talking about moving into a new geological epoch called the Anthropocene. And the definitions of these things are... For scientists are around is geology. So in the past, time is separated by looking at rocks. So the early part of rocks is about sediments. So record natural data storage devices of Earth. So sediments building up records and what we can see in those sediments. So we're looking for the first period when humans can really, when we can see the impact of humans. And the first one of those we see on a global scale is after Columbus went to the Americas for the first time and took pigs and other farm animals, but also a lot of diseases as well. And that globalization of species is a signature of the Anthropocene. And what happened when those diseases arrived is that though indigenous people had no immunity to them, and around 50 million people died as a result of those diseases. And they were almost all farmers in Central and South America, and their fields grew back to forest and sucked enough carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that we can see it in the records from ice cores in Antarctica. So we can see a dip in the CO2 in the atmosphere from the growing trees, and we can see from records around the world that Earth got cooler at that time for around 100 years. So it's a small, early change of what we can see in the sediments, and from that point onwards, we're in this new period moving to a new state of the Anthropocene.
So to simplify this, the Anthropocene idea is that humans are so important in terms of their impact on the natural environment that it's got to, the era we're in has got to be branded a sort of human-influenced era, essentially.
Exactly. That what we do is significant.
And you date it from the sort of 1650 sort of time.
Yeah.
Now, beyond that, where does it then take you to the challenges we face? I mean, humans are having this impact. I think you say in your book, 3 trillion trees have been lost since human civilization, but 1.5 trillion in the last couple of hundred years, correct?
Correct.
So where does that, and we've got climate change and all of those challenges, biodiversity, where does that take you then in terms of the urgency?
So it's, you know, it's really urgent because the global economy, this all drives back to the global economy, its function and its size. So we see, like, we've lost 3 trillion trees. We've also produced enough concrete to cover the entire Earth in a layer 2 millimeters thick. We've produced enough plastic to entirely cling film the whole Earth. And those fibers from that plastic are now in almost all of our drinking water and much of our seafood if we eat it. So the scale of the global economy and how it functions is really important. And it's going to double in size, growing at 3% a year in the next 23 years, and double again. So it's really urgent that we tackle these environmental problems head on.
And in your book, you lay out 3 different futures for dealing with this challenge of the Anthropocene. Do you want to just briefly say what they are, and then we'll talk about some of the solutions? It will get more cheerful. I promise you, it'll get more cheerful.
It's not all total doom and gloom. So here we have, you could sketch out 1 of 3 possible futures. We might just model through, taking each environmental problem as it comes and trying to put a sticking plaster over it, and then coming up with another one and seeing another using another sticking plaster. We might not tackle these environmental problems. We might have a real social collapse where environmental problems and other social problems override the political systems we have in place to deal with problems. Or we might see much more fundamental structural change where we really tackle these problems head on and move towards a new mode of living different from the one we have.
And that's what you're advocating, basically. Number 3.
I think
neither muddling on nor collapse.
I see it hard. Well, I don't want to see collapse. And I don't want to see billions of people suffering through some kind of collapse, or just muddling through and leaving hundreds of millions in poverty. So I'd rather see systemic change that allows people to flourish and the natural environment and the other species we share this earth with.
So can we talk about the 2 solutions that you propose in the book? I mean, that slightly oversimplifies it, but you can kind of boil it down to 2 big ideas. The first is half Earth. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So the idea of half Earth is from an American biologist, E.O. Wilson, who puts it that the idea that we should give half of Earth's surface to all the other species we share this planet with. So we more or less keep one half, and all the other species get the other half. And that will allow species to adapt to the rapidly changing climate and for other species to flourish while we do as well.
And say a little bit more about the implications of half Earth. I mean, how realistic is that compared to where we are now? What would it mean? What would we do? What would happen in the other half of the Earth?
So we currently have around 15% of the land surface that is in some kind of legal protection for the species that live there. So we'd be going a big jump from there, and that would require some changes. But change is already afoot. There was new data out last week, so we normally think that that around 50% of the world's population is urban. But actually, it's probably more like around 80 to 85% of the world's population is urban. So that we can take pressure off the land, and if we increase the productivity and the losses from farming, reduce the losses from farming, then we can increase the outputs from agricultural land, allowing rewilding to occur outside of those farmland areas. And I think it's important that, in terms of the Anthropocene, because it's such a fundamentally new, kind of deep idea that what we do really matters, it changes our perspective on nature. We have an idea of nature that comes from the Industrial Revolution of pristine national parks compared to dirty industry. And actually the Anthropocene says that we are actually part of nature and that we are part of helping it flourish, and therefore we can be involved in it and we can go ahead with rewilding projects where we let natural processes run, but we guide those natural processes to bring species back and allow ecosystem processes and functions to unfold. So I think it's an idea that brings about a new kind of idea about what nature is and how we interact with it.
And you're advocating this for biodiversity reasons, but also for climate change reasons, correct? Just say a little bit about the climate change reasons, because I think it's kind of important context for this.
Sure. So in terms of climate change, we can plant trees so around half the dry weight of a tree is carbon. So you can plant trees and it will remove carbon from the atmosphere and reduce the rate and magnitude of climate change. Trees also have a much more local effect in terms of cooling regionally, which is also good in these hot times. And we need to preserve big areas of nature. So last year, me and my team, we discovered for the first time that in the center of the Congo Basin is the world's largest tropical peatland. So that peatland that no one knew existed, it was a wetland, but no one had looked underground. And this peat has been accumulating there for 10,000 years and stores around 30 billion tons of carbon. So that carbon can stay locked in.
Which is the equivalent of how much?
About 3 years' worth of global emissions from all sources.
I think it's worth pausing on this. So because we met Simon on the train and he happened to mention this. He discovered the largest tropical peatland in the world last year. Nobody knew it existed. They knew there was a marshland there, but they didn't know it was a peatland. Now, the difference between the two is one is a much better way of absorbing carbon than the other. But correct.
Correct. So in a peatland where it's wet all year round, then when the plants die and the leaves die, then they don't get fully decomposed. So a small amount of that leaf material and wood material accumulates over time and is stored as carbon, keeping it out of the atmosphere. The scale of this peatland is, it's immense. It's about the size of England.
And nobody knew it existed.
And people knew it was a wetland, and very, very few people live there, and very few people go very far into the wetland where the peatland really starts. And no one really was digging down four, five,
and,
six
And incidentally,
meters.
Since Simon discovered this, a treaty has now been signed by the Democratic Republic of Congo and...
The Republic of Congo.
And the Republic of Congo to protect this peatland in perpetuity. So it was discussed. Yeah, big round of applause for that, I think. So basically, I mean, this is a bit simplistic, but we need more of that.
Yes, we need to preserve the places around the world that are ecosystems with very high carbon stocks. So peatlands in the UK and in the tropics and the rest of Europe and northern boreal zones, and tropical rainforests of these super carbon dense across the equatorial regions. But yeah, these places with tree cover and places with high storage in the soils, like peatlands, really need to be preserved.
And we should talk about the other solution that you propose, and regular listeners to the podcast will have heard us talk about this. This is UBI. So for people who don't know, can you tell us a bit about UBI and how specifically that would help?
The universal basic income, yeah.
Sure. So this is slightly off-piste for many scientists to write about. But universal basic income is where every citizen of a country would get an income to allow them to live, to provide for their basic needs of housing, food, and other clothing and other basic needs. And how this fits into thinking about the environment is that we think that it may change consumption habits. So what we do as people is that we all go to work, and we have to be really productive at work because someone else will come along who's more productive and take our job. So we have to be more productive year on year. And the payback for that production is that we get to consume ever more and more. And it makes little sense to change our consumption habits when we know that next year and in 10 years' time we'll still have to be working harder. Whereas universal basic income allows us to break that production and consumption cycle. We would all have more time to care for ourselves, more time to care for others, and more time to think about what we do beyond the next payday. We will be able to plan for the long term. And you know, the Anthropocene is not a great thing to think about. Lots of really grim statistics. But one thing it really forces us, I think, to do is to think about the longer term. And that's one way about linking today's pressing economic issues for ourselves and thinking about the longer term.
You talk in the book about consumption. There's a terrifying statistic about consumption in the by the richest billion people in the world, which includes everybody in here. Yeah.
Yeah. So the, if there are about 7.5 billion people on Earth, the richest billion, their consumption habits in terms of the amount of plastic they use, the metals they use, the fossil fuels they use, is around 5 to 10 times the amount of the average of the other 6.5 billion. So if those 6.5 billion all move themselves up to the consumption habits of a rate of the top billion, then that's like a planet having 32 billion people on it at today's consumption rates.
So that's not good, really.
Which even if we have a really positive view about, well, we'll manage with a couple of billion extra, that's 32 billion people. That would be a huge imposition on everything else, and it's unclear whether that's manageable as a globally connected network of cultures. So that says that actually the Anthropocene is an environmental issue, but it's also an issue around inequality and around moving to much more equality globally, but breaking that production and consumption levels to bring them to something more sustainable.
Okay, let's go to the audience. I'm sure they've got questions about the environment, the Anthropocene, what we should all be doing, how we can make this more positive for people to show that actually it is a better life. People, who would like to ask a question? What's your name, sir?
It's Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Top three things, really. What can we do to make a difference ourselves?
Good question.
Good question. So I'll start from something personally. So there's some really good evidence recently in the scientific literature that some of the biggest things that you can do individually is around changes to your diet. So less meat and dairy consumption, more fruit and vegetables, can have a big impact on carbon emissions.
Because
livestock are incredibly inefficient ways of producing calories and protein, and they produce the methane, which is a greenhouse gas, which exacerbates the climate change on top of the land area and inefficiency.
And we did an episode, just to plug the podcast for a second, we did an episode on this, and it doesn't say you've got to go vegan tomorrow, you can if you like, no. But it's about at least cutting down the amount of meat we eat. Carry on, though.
I think in terms of, for example, plastic pollution, so no single-use plastic and short-life plastic should be biodegradable is something that we should be really lobbying for rather than just thinking about plastic straws. And then, you know, many of these things we can't just do through individual lifestyle changes. We have to do it collectively. So I was involved in campaigns in the 1990s to stop Britain building a fleet of new coal-fired power stations. And actually, a huge campaign across all sectors of society, including scientists, got that policy shifted. And now we're seeing a retiring of coal-fired power stations, and we won't have any by 2025. And we already have stretches of hours and sometimes days where renewables are powering almost all of the UK economy.
And in case you think it all sounds hopeless and you can't do anything, we were discussing this as well on the way here. The levels of emissions in Britain are now back to the levels they were at in 1890, despite our economy being miles bigger. So, you know, it does show, I mean, I'm not saying it should be business as usual, but it does show you can have an effect. Let's take some more questions. Who else wants? Oh, yes, lots of people. Lady in the front row, and then lady standing up in the blue.
Nona from Crawley. You kind of touched on it. What big solutions do we need at a government level or wider than that to tackle this issue going beyond plastic straws?
Okay, beyond plastic straws. And let's take the lady in the blue, and then we'll get a response on that from Simon.
This is a question sort of about universal basic income.
What's your name, sorry?
Oh, sorry, it's Kat.
Hi.
From the States. I'm sorry.
Not at all.
I didn't vote Trump.
No.
I didn't.
Our quarrel is with the president, not with the American people.
I appreciate that. We appreciate that. But I would just like to preface by saying I support the idea of a universal basic income, but I'm just curious, talking about the environmental impacts, you sort of reference that universal basic income would sort of assist the environment, but I'm curious how you would mitigate by bringing everyone up when it comes to sort of their economic state. That would then increase consumption. What do we then do? It's sort of, I guess, the problem. If we get everyone to be at the same point as the billion of us here in the West, the level that they're consuming at, how would we help the environment?
Okay, so Kat asks, you know, what's the perverse effects going to be of the UBI? And Nona from Crawley asks, what are the big solutions?
Yeah, I'll take the UBI one first. So I think we have to distinguish between impacts in places like the UK and the US and places like, say, Kenya or Rwanda, where there are experiments going on. So people need to increase their consumption of certain things if they're really poor. You know, we need to increase consumption of education. We need to increase consumption of clean water in lots of places, of food for about 800 million people. So bringing those people up, I have no problem with, and there will be structural questions around how food is supplied and its environmental impact that's slightly separate from the UBI question. But then for the bulk of people, a UBI allows them to think about the future. And, you know, I've done it. I go to work and I say, oh, I deserve to buy a sandwich in a plastic wrapper with foodstuffs from all over the world because I'm working and I deserve it. And I'm too busy to do X, Y, and Z, so I buy fast consumption, things that allow me to do stuff even faster because I've got so little time. And that would all lessen, and we would all be, I will unloosen that knot of production.
So it's a working less thing. Partly you think it's a working less.
It's a working less, and it's working at the pace that you would prefer to. So if you have very young kids, then you might work less. And then you probably work.
I like the idea of a 3-day weekend myself, actually.
Yeah. You know, there's enough. In the UK, we have a redistribution problem, not a wealth problem. So I think it's about how we think and about what we think we deserve from work. And if we think we deserve from work to have, a good life that respects other people and respects the environment, then we're more likely to do that in that policy environment rather than seeing it as a kind of dog-eat-dog. I got to work harder now, and I'm going to consume now in case someone else does.
Okay, and go to Nona's question about big solutions. You said a little bit, but...
So in terms of big solutions, the Committee on Climate Change, I think, is doing important work. So it sets five-year carbon budgets.
That's the independent committee that advises the government, for those who don't know. Yeah.
So it's a five-year budget going down to 2050 to get down to 80% less emissions than we had in 1990 by 2050. So the first thing to do is we've been meeting those, but we're projected to not meet the next one because of policy decisions now by the current government. So we could get back on track to meet that and meet the future targets in terms of climate change mitigation. So we've done lots of easy things about closing coal-fired power stations, but you can't keep closing them because they're already all scheduled to close. So we have to move to things like transport and get that down to zero emissions. So that's moving to electric cars, much more public transport, and then some offsetting of that small amount of emissions that remain. So taking each sector and working out how it gets to zero emissions is a kind of big issue. And then on top of that, we see from this summer's real heat wave and that these temperatures will become more normal as we go into the future. And many of us will spend summers in a kind of Mediterranean type climate that we will need to adapt. So much more focus in terms of policy on how we adapt to climate change, our national infrastructure, water supplies, what kind of crops we can grow as we go into the future is the other kind of side of the puzzle.
Can I just add to that? One way I think about this is what I call the triple zero option, which is we should be zero emissions by 2050. So I legislated for us to cut our emissions by 80% by 2050, but that is not enough when you look at the challenge. And actually, every country's now signed up to getting to zero emissions. Rich countries have got to get there by 2050. Secondly, as Simon says, we should have zero carbon vehicles, and we shouldn't wait till 2040 for zero carbon vehicles. We should do it much quicker than that. And then thirdly, zero carbon homes. We did legislate the Labour government for zero carbon homes, and that has been got rid of. It is absolutely crazy for us to be building homes which are not zero carbon, given the massive challenges we face in the household sector.
One more round.
Yeah. I think we've got time for one more round, maybe. Yep, there's a lady here in the fourth row.
Hello.
Hi.
A few years ago...
What's your name?
Annabelle.
Hi.
About 2 or 3 years ago, there was a projection that we would be eating a lot of insects in a few years' time. That they are...
Not just on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
No.
Have you been offered that?
I haven't, actually, no. I was offered the after show. I thought that was a bit... but I wouldn't do the other one either, just for the record.
I think you'd be good.
No, I think not.
You know, they're easy to keep control of. They're, you know, easy to store. They're very high in protein. Is there, as the future of food goes on, will that become a more viable option for Western countries who don't tend to incorporate that as part of their diet, apart from the exotic?
That is a very unusual question. Good question. Insect eating. Okay, Annabelle says, should we be eating insects? Let's just go back a few rows.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Callum. I'm from Bishop Stortford. So every, you know, activity and goal to help make the world and humanity more sustainable should be rewarded, but due to the Earth's, you know, nature as a celestial body, it will eventually end. And I spend quite a lot of time thinking about how, if humanity will, you know, reach past that. Do you think it's ever a worthwhile endeavour in either a scientific or policy kind of arena to think about how to, you know, ensure human civilization gets past the possibly biggest challenges it could ever face?
This is like Elon Musk sort of territory, isn't it? Yeah. So Callum asks, should we go and colonise other planets, sort of? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Esther.
Hi.
I was just... my question is UBI a realistic proposition for the political state that we live in at the moment? Like, it's obviously growing in popularity, but I just wonder, like, how would it be implemented? Would it be voted? That sort of thing.
Should we eat insects? Should we colonise other planets? And is UBI realistic in the political context? I can say something about that, maybe.
So should we eat insects? I have no problems with eating them, although the ones I have eaten in the Congo Basin I haven't enjoyed.
What were they?
Oh, they eat these grubs.
Right.
A really big, disgusting.
Right.
To be fair, to my palate. So I no problem with that. I suspect that actually all this work on fake meat, so growing meat in a lab, so we avoid all the animal welfare issues and some of the resource issues, might be a way that goes forward that's more palatable to more people than either eating insects or veganism, I suspect.
So veggie burgers, not grasshoppers, basically. Colonizing other planets?
I just do not see how we can organize to create a fully functioning ecosystem that can feed and reproduce a large enough human population to have a full-scale colony when we can't manage a handful of, say, national parks really well.
And UBI? Do you want to say something about UBI? Or do you want me to...
I think you're probably a better
thing,
person.
The thing I would say about the UBI is, look, it is definitely not going to happen tomorrow, but I think you got... The thing I like most about it is it thinks big about what kind of society we want to be and asks ourselves, well, you know, do we want people to have more choice about how much they work, what they do, the power to say no to their boss, all of those things. And I think the very least we should be doing is trying it out. And increasingly... just to go to the realism point, other countries are trying it out. It's been tried out in Scotland, a little bit in Finland. I'm not sure the experiment was great in Finland. I think the Netherlands might be doing it. So let's try it out. And I think if you try it out, then you can see, you know, what results it produces. Believe it or not, it was tried out in the 1970s by Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, Republican President of the United States, who has a bad reputation on a number of fronts. But actually, you know, and there's still an argument going on about whether those experiments were successful or not. But I think the appetite tells you something about the power of the idea. Now, hopefully the lady at the back has got the microphone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, my name's Liz. I come from Leicestershire. My question was about UBI as well. How are we going to sell it to the vested interests and the Daily Mail reading public who are in the state that we're in currently, where welfare is seen as a privilege, not a right? I can't see how we're ever going to be able to sell it to those sort of people.
Okay.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'm from Barnsley, actually, so from your constituency. I wonder if perhaps before we tackle the Everest of universal basic income, perhaps we could try something like a land value tax, which might help to redistribute some of the income in the UK.
We've got an episode on that too, actually. Right.
So I think on persuading people, I think this is where the trials really come in, so that people can see the evidence of what happens rather than thinking about, you know, who's deserving or not deserving or whatever. And I think pointing out some of those things like child benefit, we already have a universal system. We already have universal... safety nets. So it's really they're not very netty at the moment. They've got some big holes in. So I think it's not necessarily too far. And something that's universal, like the National Health Service, is in some ways an easier sell than saying some people are deserving and some people are not deserving, because everyone gets it equally.
I also think that what I would add to that, Liz, is it definitely is a tough sell. But the reason it's a tough sell, as you rather implied, is the idea that people aren't going to work and they're just going to laze around, right? But actually, if you can show that when you've experimented with it, that is not what happens. And I think it's a sort of gamble on human nature. I actually don't think most people would laze around. And in fact, the pilots that have been done suggest that isn't what happens. It provides people with a basic safety net. It's not that generous so that people can just laze around and have a great life, but it's enough for people to live on, and lots of people will then build on that. So I sort of think, I think it's worth a try.
So we have a thing on the podcast. I think it's a wonderful vision for the future. It's called the Jeffocracy, and it's very much a utopian society with me installed as the benign leader.
Not that benign, actually.
So if I were to appoint you climate change secretary, day one, what is the first thing? I'm giving you free rein. Day one, what's the first thing you do?
So I would... I would reduce the carbon budgets so that we are in line with the carbon budgets required for limiting emissions to 1.5 degrees C, as it says in the Paris Agreement. And then as a mechanism towards getting there, I would have the, you know, you produce it, you have to dispose of it policy, where if in the UK you produce fossil fuel, so from the North Sea or coal, then you have to sequester and remove and put into geological storage exactly the same amount of carbon that you put into the world, so that the polluter not just pays, but actually solves the problem.
Well, look, Simon, thank you so much for joining us. Please give a huge, huge hand to Simon Lewis, everybody.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And please welcome to Pitch Some Ideas, which could be reasons to be cheerful. We're joined by comedian Jem Brister.
Oh God, that was quite full on, wasn't it?
It was. He's got the answers, though.
He's got the answers. Thank God, someone's got the answers. That was getting progressively really bleak, wasn't it?
Yeah,
but at least we don't have to eat insects.
I've eaten those witchetty grubs. Have you not? Have you ever tried those?
No.
That's all I have to say on the matter. I've eaten them. They are a delicacy.
Are they like eating nuts, are they, in a little bag?
No, they're like eating grubs.
Okay.
They're exactly like that. I don't know why anyone would choose to do it if they could eat.
In what context were you eating them?
Oh, I was in Australia and they were like, would you like to eat this witchetty grub? And I was like, yeah, mate. And I was like, no, this is absolutely revolting. But I was up for it at the time. Yeah.
You brought along some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful.
Yes.
Do you want to give us your first one?
My first one is I do some work with a charity called Bloody Good Period. And
For people who don't know what that is, do you want to explain?
They do fantastic work where they basically provide sanitary wear for women who can't afford it and for refugees. And I think that rather than having... rather than having a charity that has to provide this, and I think they're doing great work, is sanitary products should be freely available for women who can't afford them. End of. If you can afford them, buy them, of course. But if you can't afford them, it's like condoms. You know, you can go to a sexual health clinic and get a whole bag full of condoms. That should be the same for women if they can't afford sanitary products. We live in a civilized society. We live in a time where there's period poverty, which is just insane. That shouldn't exist. If you need them, go out and get them. If men had periods, come on. You'd be able to get them behind the bar. They'd be free. We wouldn't be... We have to pay... They're not only not free for us, we have to pay VAT, don't we, ladies?
Yes.
Because they're a luxury item. Does it feel like a luxury? I'm pretty sure it doesn't feel... It doesn't feel like a luxury to me. So, yes, that would be my first.
So it'd be like a food bank principle.
Yeah, but I think it would be just...
So that's the way to describe it.
I don't think I would describe it that way.
No, but in as much as people who don't need to use food banks don't...
I think it should be attached to your...
Themselves.
Maybe to your GP. You know, you just pop in and go, can I just get a couple of bags of whatever you use, tampons or sanitary, and then away you go. And there's no shame in it. There's no embarrassment about it. They're just free. It's legal. Boof, off you go. If you can afford them, bam, pay for them. This whole embarrassment, like, that we can't talk about the fact that women bleed. We bleed! Every month! Look around you! There's women bleeding all over the place! Just don't talk about it! Talk about it, for heaven's sake! You know, we don't talk about periods, we don't talk about menopause, it's like Fight Club, no one knows what the hell's going on. Just talk about it.
We buy the argument.
Yeah, we'll have that. All right, what else you got, Jen?
Well, I've got two boys, I've got twins, they're 3 and a half, and I think it should be compulsory from about the age of 8, 9 that young boys are given emoting classes in school,
Emoting.
Emoting. So they learn to just get in touch with how they feel. There's no shame in crying. There's no shame in expressing your emotions. And you just go in. Because my kids, they are full-time emoters at the moment. They have like, you know, oh, I wanted a blue bowl. Oh, there's a little bit of milk on my T-shirt. And then you get to 10 and we're told, you know, you're not allowed to express yourself. Yeah. And I think if men were given that, because I think there's something about, let's find ways of being able to emote generally and not associate emotions with being less than. Because emotions are attached to women. Women, we still don't live in an equal society. So anything that's attached to emotions is seen as weak because it's to do with women. No, let's just say, you want to have a cry fella off your trot? Don't wait for England to lose the next World Cup. Have a little cry now.
But you're not advocating 3-year-old levels of emoting. So if I spill milk on my shirt, no, I don't need to have a full on tantrum.
Don't scream for a yellow bowl for 2 hours. Just, you know, just the normal amount of emotional response.
And where do you think
response.
We do? Is it in schools? Is it
in school? Home? Absolutely. In school. And with, and also, just if men are allowed to express themselves, I guarantee you, you know, the domestic violence and you know, violence perpetrated against women by men, I bet there would be a big reduction.
Yeah.
Are they good at emoting your boy?
Oh, 100%. I mean, they've got two mums. They're like, they're just, oh, mummy, I just feel, this is how I feel about the unicorns. You know, they're fine.
Are you a good, when was the last time you cried, Dad?
Oh, God.
Are you not a good emoter?
I think I cried a bit at Three Lions. I found it quite moving, all the Three Lions stuff.
Yeah.
I think they
because
be...
I remembered Euro 96 and, you know, I was younger. I found all of the England stuff quite moving.
Yeah, but then don't you think that that is like you're projecting, you feel sad about other things, you go, well, I'm not allowed to cry about that, so... Three Lions.
The general election of 2015, you mean? You think I was projecting? Actually,
let's start.
To give credit to my son, my younger son, my wife said to him the day after because they were really upset about the World Cup. And she said, well, you know, Daddy was really upset about the general election. He said, oh, come on. He said, the general election is much more important than the World Cup. So at least he's sort of reasonably well trained.
He gets it, Ed. Yeah, there should be more crying in PMQs often.
More crying in
PMQs? Yeah. I look at them sometimes.
Sometimes I felt like crying in PMQs, actually. You think that would be good for crying in PMQs?
Well, every now and again. If someone could make Boris Johnson cry, see, maybe that's one thing.
But, you know, I think there is something interesting about this, and it is to do with Gareth Southgate, or Sir Gareth Southgate, as he will soon be known. I think, you see, he has definitely brought a different form of leadership. I think one of the reasons people have been so positive about him is he's brought a different form of leadership.
Oh, 100%.
Yes, you know, he was honest about missing the penalty and, you know, what in Euro 96 and what that meant for him and how terrible it was and all of that. And when you heard his interviews with his players, it was all about him getting to know his players, what made them tick and all that. So I think he might be the sort of good leader for your campaign.
I think if Gareth Southgate wants to champion this campaign, then I'm 100% definitely. Behind it.
Definitely.
He was really good at like saying, you know, this is an England we should be proud of. We have a multicultural and very diverse ethnic background in this team. And this is what we should be proud of this country. And this is what we should be proud of. Not like, you know...
He is going to be busy with the Brexit negotiations when he gets back. So he might not be able to lead your campaign, but I mean, you know, if you could do that as a sideline,
if you could try and fit it in, I'd be very grateful. Yeah, Ed, maybe you could have a word.
Yeah, I'll try. Now, maybe there are some reasons to be potential things that could make us cheerful in the audience.
Any ideas?
This is your chance for a very short Dragon's Den, the ideas that could transform the country.
Hi, I think there should be twice as many ladies lose as men's lose everywhere.
Oh, I think that's good,
especially
Preach.
In attitude.
Preach.
What is the ladies' loo situation like at Latitude? I haven't checked it out yet, but what is the situation?
Lengthy.
Much worse than the men's.
Yeah.
I mean, it is obviously true that you can see it's a world designed by men when you look at loos all in any place you go to, isn't it?
I know. What is this? It's like 25 urinals, and then they have cubicles, and then we're expected to queue for 2 loos. It's like, it's absurd. Maybe not here, there are more than 2, but that is the general makeup of most toilets in most venues around the country. So, yeah, that's a brilliant point.
Okay, I think that's a pretty good policy. There's a lady here as well.
I think paternity leave should be made compulsory. Then actually men would be at home with the kids, know what it's about, and the whole glass ceiling professionally would go.
And they should get 6 months, shouldn't they, as well, instead of 2 weeks. That should be...
Yeah.
There is something very interesting about this, which is in Scandinavia, and Jeff is a big sort of Swedophile. In Scandinavia, they have a policy, I think it's in Sweden, isn't it?
Yeah.
Called use it or lose it. Yeah. So men get 3 months paternity leave, but if they don't take it, it can't be transferred over to the woman. I mean, obviously, mothers get, I think, 9 months or...
They get almost a year, don't
or
they?
Or a year, yeah. Something like a year. But men have 3 months. And it is... I mean, just being in Stockholm a few months ago, it was just so... You just see lots of men in on the streets with their babies, which you just don't see in the same way in this country.
And also, then we'd stop saying, isn't it lovely when you see a dad out with his kids? Well, they are his kids, aren't they? So, yeah.
Okay, and there's a lady here. If you just pass the microphone along, we're doing this very well. Yep. What's your name?
Claire.
Claire, hi.
Claire from Cheshire, hi.
Claire from Cheshire.
I'd like to encourage politicians to have work experience before they decide to go into the role.
I think that's aimed at you, Jeff.
Didn't you do 4 weeks on a magazine or something?
Fuck off, yeah. Carry on, Claire. Yeah, I'm loving that I called you Claire. I'm really pleased that I chose you. Keep going. Go on, why? Yeah.
Well, I'm concerned that we primarily have politicians that are very egotistical and focus on self and not really taking on a long-term view. And also we end up with a Minister of Health who doesn't understand health. We have a Minister of Education who doesn't understand education. And I'm concerned that we don't have the right people taking on politics. I think we need to encourage more people to go into it.
I think you make a really interesting point about the fact that it almost seems to be a qualification of going into a role that you know nothing about it when you go into the role. And it's not like any other... And actually, the process of appointing people... I felt this as leader of the Labour Party. The process of appointing people is like no other, because you can't really interview people. You've just got to sort of pick people for the role. And the process of people getting the job, you need no prior expertise in the job. I mean, I think you are right about that.
And I'm very happy to design an assessment centre.
Okay. I think all politicians, including me, should go to an assessment centre.
I think that's all we have time for.
It is. I think we should thank Jen.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival.
Yes.
Your show is called Meaningless.
Yes, my show is called Meaningless at the Edinburgh Festival, and I'm also on tour from September with the same show title.
Great.
Thank you very much, guys.
Jen Brister, thank you so much.
I think we should thank our fantastic audience for being a fantastic audience. We
thank
love
you.
I'll give you a big round of applause for being a fantastic audience. We'd like to thank Simon Lewis. Go and buy his book after this.
And Emma Corsham produced our podcast with backup and research from Alex Feisbrice and Lindsay Todd. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the iDeads. Ed Seed wrote the music, and the artwork was by
Emily Power.
Yes. Thanks to Tanya at Latitude for inviting us to come today. We've really enjoyed it.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
He's been Ed Miliband.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Thank you very much, everybody.